Today I want to talk about this idea of 97% of people don't succeed while 3% of people do succeed. In the United States in the last few years, we've seen a battle between what has been referred to as the 1% versus the 99%. In this scenario, the 1% really represents the people who are multi-billionaires. They have so much money that compared to the 99%, it is the ultra-wealthy versus the impoverished. Now, there is a lot of variation in that 99%, but the fact of the matter is the 1% through their lobbying, through their donations, through their control of the economic system have so much power, have so much influence, have so much money and control over life on this planet, not just in the United States, but elsewhere as well, that the playing field is tilted severely toward the 1%. In self-improvement circles, it's pretty much accepted that 97% of the people that buy self-improvement packages, books, videos, and programs and so on are not going to get very much benefit out of them. Only 3% will actually take that information and convert it into knowledge that has a direct and dramatic influence and effect on their lives. 97% are going to get almost nothing out of it, and 3% will get a lot out of it. That's kind of sad. Recently, we conducted, that is my wife and I, with a bunch of other people, a weight and size intensive. We recognize that people's feelings, ourselves included, about how we look in a mirror, how our clothes fit, how it feels to move an overly heavy body around, can be discouraging. So we did that weight and size intensive. Since then, well, we recognize that obesity around the world is an all-time high, and it's going to get higher. Everybody knows this over the years, probably 30 or 40, maybe 50 years, that billions and billions of dollars are spent on diets, diet books, diet programs, diet foods, low-fat foods, low-sugar foods, these kind of things, exercise programs, exercise machines, etc. And it goes on and on and on. But the great majority, I don't know if it's 97%, but the great majority ends in failure. I saw something either this morning or yesterday that said 70% of the healthcare costs in the United States are spent on illnesses directly connected to obesity. I was like, wow, maybe we could stress that a little bit and say to somebody, if you want to save a tremendous amount of pain and suffering and maybe even a lot of your own money, you're going to want to deal with your obesity. But this talk is not really about obesity. It's about why is failure so common? And why do we accept this failure rate as normal? Why is 97% failure rate? Well, that's the way it is. And next. Well, it's not causing these people to fail who are selling stuff to that 97%. The failure is the 97% who is buying it, putting it on the shelf, putting it in the drawer, not reading it, not opening it, not doing anything with it, not applying it to make changes in their lives. Why do we, as the 97%, why do we, as the purveyors of this material, accept that failure? I think it's a problem. On some level, I see this as happening on a political level, that controlled by the 1%. And I had an experience years ago. I was applying for a job with a consulting company, and part of their acceptance of me and a bunch of other guys was to really put us through a grueling examination of our backgrounds to make sure we were upstanding moral citizens and et cetera, et cetera. So they put us under a microscope. And then their part of their training was to give us material to memorize. We had to memorize a presentation that we would make in front of prospects that we called upon throughout the country. We would have to do it word for word. So they put tremendous pressure on us to memorize this word for word. And I realized shortly after that is they put all that pressure on us, making us be the hamsters on the treadmill, so we couldn't question them. We couldn't examine them. We couldn't put this consulting practice under a microscope and see it for what it was. Like, So they put us on the treadmill and made us be the hamsters because didn't give us enough time. The pressure to memorize, the pressure to perform was so great, we were not thinking. When people are held in that survival mode, either in a job situation like I just described or in life, when you're trying to pay the rent or pay the mortgage or buy food for your family, you're not doing much thinking. There's not much thinking going on. That stress is all about reaction. I'm trying to survive. I'm trying to survive. I don't have time for these higher moral questions about what's good for the country and what's good for my state and what's good for my municipality. I'm trying to survive. That's by design, in my opinion. You know what? Because people in that state are not challenging the 1%. They're busy surviving. I don't have time to fight you. My children need food. If I turned around and said to you that I thought the United States educational system is in serious need for improvement, you probably wouldn't be surprised. If you've thought about this at all, you'd probably go, you know what? You know what? I feel this way as well. This is a real, real need of that. Because children, from the earliest days of schooling, preschool now, and then kindergarten, and then various grades on up to 12, they move from grade to grade. And then what we've recognized now, if you do any reading about it, is people are graduating from high school, and then when they go to college, they have to enter remedial English classes, remedial math classes, remedial everything classes. It's like, wow, college, instead of being an advanced level of education, is actually involved in remediation more than anything. These kids that graduate, and I think maybe anything, you could say graduated from sixth grade, graduated from eighth grade, graduated from the 12th grade, they're graduating without any kind of understanding of life or the necessary skills that they might want to need and might want to have in order to navigate in life. When you look back at a lot of schooling, it was kind of like that consulting company's experience. Memorize this, memorize this, facts and figures, memorize this, facts and figures, memorize this. Like, do you want my opinion? No, this is all about facts and figures. That's what you need to be able to answer on a test. You need to be able to give the correct fact or figure in response to a test. So we didn't learn how to learn. We were taught to memorize, basically like tape recorders. We didn't learn how to progress from what I'll consider the initial place of helplessness. That being helpless initially at the beginning of any activity is actually natural. So like, I feel helpless. Oh, yeah, that's natural. That's normal. Oh, cool. Now what? Well, let's move from that place to a final place of happiness. What's that mean? That's when you're going to have good feelings about yourself. And you could learn that pretty short order if you don't beat yourself up. for not being an expert after 5 minutes of activity. You move from this helplessness, you get more information, you get more practice, you get more experience, you get more knowledge, you get more support, you get more energy, and at some point in this progression, you're going to go, you know what, I feel pretty effective. I think I'm starting to get this idea, whether it's learning how to type or write or tie your shoes or bake a cake or any number of things. But we didn't learn that. We didn't learn that. Hey, you know, you're going to have these feelings. Feelings? We can't talk about feelings. We only talk about facts and figures. If we talked about these feelings, these people would be in a position to go, oh, you know, I had feelings. I had feelings. I felt this. I felt that. But we didn't learn to recognize them. We didn't learn to use those emotions to give us power to persist. Like, oh, I feel this way, I quit. Why? Oh, isn't that what you do? When you have that feeling, don't you quit? I was afraid, so I quit. I was angry, so I quit. I was sad, so I quit. Where did you learn that? Where did you learn that? We learned that in our families. We learned that in school because nobody taught us anything differently. If we learned, oh, you got these emotions? No problem. No problem. Recognize them. Put a name to them. Oh, yeah. And guess what? If you're a human, you're going to have these experiences. I think the fact is dogs have these experiences, perhaps cats as well, maybe other animal species as well. They have emotions. Oh, living beings. And as we go up the scale, maybe they get more complex for human beings than they would be for a rat. But we didn't recognize them. We weren't taught about them. We didn't see them as our ally. If somebody had said to us when we were in school, let's say you're a third grader or a fifth grader or a sixth grader, some level in school we would have been able to recognize certain concepts. I recall a person teaching me this idea about the difference between immature thinking and mature thinking. Immature thinking is when a person has an emotion and that becomes the determining factor in the action they take. I was afraid, so I ran. I was afraid, so I got angry. And I was afraid, so I hit somebody. I got angry, and I punched somebody. And it goes on and on. So people have emotions, and they think as a result of that emotion, I'm going to take this action or inaction, which is an action in itself. And then after the fact, it's like, now I have to make a decision about it. I have to rationalize what I did. The reason you punched Joey in the nose was he made me mad. He made me mad. I took action. Hey, I mean, isn't that how it works? It works that way if you're thinking immaturely. The other point of view was, what's mature thinking? We make a decision. Based upon that decision, we take certain actions. And then we're going to have certain feelings, certain emotions as a result of that. And we use emotions to reinforce the decision we made in the first place, not to quit, but I got to adjust. I need to tweak it this way. I got to take a slightly different act, or all the head full. This is a good thing I'm doing here. But we use the emotions to reinforce the decision so we can accomplish something. I think there may even be a third possibility. I'll call it, for the want of a better expression, positive reality. Positive reality. What is that? What does that mean? I think we make a decision. I want something. This is what I want and why I want it. That why is going to trigger emotions in me. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. If it's ego-driven, that's going to be emotions, but it's going to not be that heart-centered power that we're really looking for. So we have a decision. This is what I want. This is why I want it. My emotions are naturally going to be engaged, and now the person who takes actions is much more powerful, much more present, much more engaged otherwise, and then, based upon the action we take, we can use the feedback of the emotions. Oh, that felt good, or, you know, I think I ran into a wall, or whatever it happens to be. And then we use the emotions to justify the decision. And if we need to adjust, we adjust. If we need to go all ahead full, that's what we do. But we don't use them to quit, because we made the decision in the first place, presumably not impulsively, right? I feel like being a billionaire. I want to be a billionaire. Well, I quit that 5 minutes later. Why? Because we weren't really engaged with it. We didn't think it through. There was no why to that that would sustain that for any length of time. That seed of a thought, I want to be a billionaire, was planted so shallowly, and it's a little teeny seed, and didn't get watered, didn't get nurtured, didn't get cared for, and it'll fizzle like a seed on a hot summer day in dry sand. That's not much of a decision. Positive reality would be a thought-through decision that engages our emotions, that triggers our actions, and then we use emotions to reinforce our direction or any adjustment that's necessary. I don't know about other people, but to me, this was a concept growing up. I would hear this, oh, he's a natural athlete. He's a natural athlete. We would describe, or other people would describe, great baseball players. Funny enough, right? A lot of them were black. Hank Aaron, he was a natural. Jackie Robinson, he was a natural. All these guys were natural. Which means what to a white man? They didn't really have to work at it. That's baloney. These guys worked at it and worked at it and worked at it. They were single-minded in their purposefulness. That was the, you know, the tip of a racist iceberg that talked about that. But if you bought into that, you're a natural. It's like, oh, so everything I do as a natural, and this is how I'll know I'm natural, if I do it, it will be very easy. Yep, that's how you know you're a natural. So if I pick up a pen and write a great American novel without putting the pen down, then I'm a natural. Yep, that's you're a natural. And if you could sit down at the piano and just start playing Tchaikovsky or Mozart or Beethoven, then you would be a natural. Oh, and if I can't do that, oh, you're not natural. You don't have natural talent. And people who bought into that, and I was one of them, it's like, wait a minute. I should only do things that I'm naturally suited for? What's that? Standing up on my hind legs, eating food, drinking beverages. I'm a natural at that sort of thing. I can sit down. I'm a natural at sitting down. I sleep well at night. I'm a natural at sleeping well. How about something a little bit more evolved, like writing and speaking and cogitating and other things? Oh, they take practice. So the people who took this natural or not natural, that's binary. I'll talk about that in a minute or two. But this idea is like, wait a minute. Instead of adopting this, if you're natural, you'll succeed at the first attempt. And if you're not natural, give it up. Quit after the first attempt. Well, human beings, you go, I watched a little baby trying to stand in the crib. It tried a few times. What's that mean? It's not a natural stander-upper? Well, that's a good point. Maybe that. Okay, I saw that child try to take a step, and it fell a couple of times. What does that mean? It's not a natural walker? It should give up trying to walk? It should quit? Or run the same thing? It should quit? That's crazy, of course. What we should have been taught is it doesn't make any difference if you're natural or not natural with regard to talent in this regard. All you have to do is understand some fundamentals and practice and adjust and practice and adjust and practice. And you can use the symbols or the concepts of either mature thinking that I described or the positive reality where you do something, that's not a straight line. No, yeah. And we can practice and practice until we get to the point where we can get good feelings because we sense some sort of progress. That's really what happiness is about. It is I feel like I'm making some sort of progress to a knowable goal. I'm not there yet. I'm not there yet. I'm not completely evolved. I'm not Christ conscious. I'm not at the pinnacle of spirituality or mentality or emotionality or physicality or finances or career or as a family man or no. But I'm making progress. Ah, that's rewarding. I'm on the path. We're on the journey. We're on the journey. I think this idea that if you're natural, you'll arrive in one moment, first attempt, you're there. But it didn't happen. It didn't happen. It didn't happen even for Mozart. Oh, he sat down at 8 and started writing. Yeah. But he didn't do his best work at 8 years old. Oh, that's a good point. He was practicing. He was learning his craft. This idea of you're natural or it's unnatural, don't do it. Quit. Succeed or fail. But that, I believe, is one of the really negative impacts, and I believe there are a lot of them, of religions. They made binary thinking standard. Good, bad, right, wrong, God, Satan, heaven, hell, that's it. That's all you need to know, kids. That's all you need to know. And, of course, try to avoid the second choice and always go for the first choice. There's only one right way. There's only one right answer, kids. There's only one right religion. That only hyphen one hyphen right hyphen answer thinking is a model. I think it's a model for the less intelligent. It's for the less courageous. Just think of it. There's only one right answer. A lot of our schooling indicated that to us. A lot of Sunday schools indicated that to us. And if you don't get the one right thing, of course you're wrong. You're wrong. You're bad. You're dumb. You're this. You're that. It's like only one right way thinking seems to me to be for human beings the same, produces the same sense that a puppy gets from going into a small confined space in a cage. They get a sense of safety. You take a puppy and you put him in a wide open space. They're insecure. And you put them in a little cage, they feel secure. They sleep better. You know, sense of safety. Well, we spent the first 9 months of our lives, right, in utero, in a small, confined space. People under trauma and all kinds of difficulties curl up into a fetal position, which is a recreation of that small, confined space. For my puppy, I bought a thunder shirt. A thunder shirt is for a dog that dogs get frightened by thunder. And you put this around them, it's like a vest, and you make it really snug and it squeezes them tightly. Now, if you don't have a thunder shirt for a dog, if you pick your dog up and you squeeze your dog in a tight hug in thunder, the dog will immediately feel secure and calm down. But the thunder shirt provides this same sort of confinement, I think, that the one right way, there's only one right way of thinking to a fearful human being. Too many choices, too much thinking. Could somebody confine my thinking? Give me a structure. Do it this way or you'll go to hell. I feel less frightened. Not more aware, but maybe less frightened for a minute, being in that confined mental, emotional, spiritual space. That binary right, wrong, good, bad, God, Satan, heaven, hell kind of thinking, I believe, needs to be replaced with scale of effectiveness. I've designed a scale of effectiveness because it dawns on me that's what we should be doing. That's the game we're playing, becoming more effective in the next moment than I was in the last moment. Oh, yeah. Horizontal line, 0 on the left, 100 on the right, midpoint, 50. We're not going to be 0, and we're never going to be 100, so let's forget those two. So we're somewhere between 35 and 40% on up to about, I guess, 75% effective. we're always effective. Always, 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 always. No matter what we do or don't do, we're always going to be effective. We're going to be on that scale somewhere. And the goal, of course, is to be more effective in the next moment than we were in the last moment. And how would you know? How would you know you're being more effective? How do you feel about yourself? Oh, I hate myself. That's less effective. Did you notice that? Oh, yeah. Just noticing that you hate yourself is a sign of effectiveness. Oh, yeah. Maybe I'm down to 20%. I'm becoming more aware. That's more effective. Yep, now you're starting to move up toward the right side. Joy, happiness, respect, generosity, patience with yourself, kindness to yourself, gentleness with yourself. That's effective. You're being effective. Good for you. Good for you. That's the way to do it. I like it. If you knew you were being effective, more or less, at every moment, you're like, I can avoid going into this human tendency to blame myself, to attack myself, to criticize myself. And because I do that, planting those seeds, now I'm trying to avoid blame, I'm trying to avoid attack, I'm trying to avoid criticism. Sure. We're producing these vibrations. Why we would think that they're not going to be a harvest for us seems kind of silly. Religions teach people to be afraid of God. Unless you're being perfectly obedient. By the way, let me show you an extremely long list of rules that are declared by these people who are telling you to be afraid of God, of love, who is wrathful and jealous. And they're in power. And so they're saying, oh, these are God's words. And don't you violate them. Or you're going to be in big trouble. So that fear of making mistakes, that fear of being bad, fear of being wrong paralyzes people, paralyzes them into inactivity, into pain, into suffering. It's like, oh yeah, this does not feel good. It does not feel good. People then turn around and go, the standards by which I'm trying to live are so impossible, I can't possibly succeed. I'm going for perfection. Well, that's 100% guarantee of failure. I'm helpless to be perfect. No kidding. So don't worry about helpless, but you can certainly throw out perfection as a goal. It's silly. It's unachievable. And it's designed to cause pain and suffering and stress, and keep people under control. So if we don't know how to deal with this sense of helplessness, I have to avoid everything that I associate with a feeling of helplessness, which is what? Basically anything new, meeting new people, going new places, thinking about new thoughts, considering new ideas, taking on new responsibilities, creating a new product, doing anything new basically is going to start from that very first point of helplessness. What do I do first? And because of this, I call it not understood helplessness, a lot of people convert that into mental and emotional pain. So look around. We talk to clients all the time with this. The pain that they're steeping themselves in because of not understood helplessness. So what do we do? What do human beings do when they're in pain? They take painkillers. Go figure. We take painkillers. A lot of it is self-medication, though. There's a lot of self-medication going on in this country. Alcohol, drugs, food, gambling, all kinds of addictions are designed to cover up the pain of helplessness. Like, how's that working? You think an alcoholic's drinking eliminates pain? what causes more? Causes family pain, causes financial pain, causes emotional pain, causes pain to his self-esteem, on and on. It causes no good things, except to maybe the people who were selling the alcohol. No, not a good thing. Understanding helplessness is essential. Religions have taught us to judge and judge and judge. Even though, as I got the Bible in my hand, yeah, doesn't it say something about not judging? Judge not, or you'll be judged? Well, somehow that gets overlooked. They cherry pick, as I do too, elements from the Bible to prove a point, and they overlook certain things. And this practice of judging, it triggers the law of cause and effect. How can it not? Judge planting a seed, judge planting a seed, judge planting a seed. And then we turn around and we get judged. We get judged by ourselves. Nobody is harsher critic of us than we are of ourselves. Like, oh, I'm afraid what they're going to say. What they're going to say is not going to compare to the amount of pain what we say to ourselves. We are so harsh in judgment of ourselves. Some people know this, at least the words, oh, I'm my own worst critic. Do you know really what that means? It means you are crippling yourself. Oh, I was just using a cliche, I know. But when we're our own worst critic, we are crippling ourselves. I didn't want to do that. No kidding. So if we judge, and we do, other people and ourselves, and we do, and then we become afraid of being judged by other people, and we are, and we're afraid of being judged by ourselves, and we are, which leads us to more inactivity, more procrastination, more pain, more suffering. It's almost like the quote, a brave man dies but one death, but a coward dies many deaths, which is another way of saying the imagination of this person is worrying about the pain, worrying about the pain, worrying about the pain. He has manufactured more pain and suffering for himself than a person who actually has the experience of the pain and suffering because of a war wound or courage or being in a battle. The imagination creates so much for us. Regret is a painful energy. Guess what? Regret can only come from judgments that we make after the fact. If you take action and you don't judge it, no regret. No, right? There wouldn't be any regret. But we do something, we look at the result, we compare it to a better version, maybe we even compare it to perfection. Maybe to perfection. It should have been perfect. I didn't do it perfectly. And then we feel regret that we didn't achieve this higher standard. It is so unfair. It is so unfair. It's unbelievable. I put a shelf in above the kitchen sink in the boat yesterday. It's not perfect. It bothers me. It's not perfect. Marianne says it's good enough. It's fine. But there are people not far from where we are who work with wood all day long, every day, building boats and doing all kinds of things. Real artists with wood. If I compare my shelf to them, I'm going to regret making that shelf. But the fact is, it serves its purpose. It's like, oh, does it serve its purpose? Yeah. Is it on par with Mona Lisa? That it could be in a museum? Well, no. But was it designed to be in a museum? No. It is that post-action judgment that leads to regret. And then, because we have habituated that, we judge everything we do as not good enough. I'm not enough. It's not good enough. I'm not good enough. It's not good enough. That I'm not good enough. That's not good enough. And we do that, and it's painful. It's painful. We go, it's hard to do stuff. Why? It's too damn painful. Why? Because once I do it, I'm going to cause myself pain through my interpretation. So the solution to that is not to do something? Yeah. How about if the solution to that is to stop judging it and causing you pain? Is that a choice I have? Yes, it's a choice we have. I suppose I could say that the 97% fail and the 3% succeed because the 97% don't know how life works. If we don't know how life works, why would we be surprised that we don't succeed at it? How's life work? I don't know. I can't figure out the rules. Oh, we did it around and said to somebody, are you successful at baseball? I don't know. I don't know baseball. Well, do you think you could be successful at baseball if you don't know how the game of baseball is played? Let me think. If I don't know how baseball is played, should I be successful at it? No. We've heard the cliche, ignorance is bliss. No, it's not. Ignorance is ignorance. Awareness is bliss. Awareness is bliss. Being aware of how life works and how divine consciousness is working is a game changer. Can I say it's a game changer? Human beings learn by trial and error. Oh, so I'm not going to go to hell because I made an error? That is correct. That is correct. That's how you learn. That's how we all learn. Okay. There is no God that demands obedience. I don't have to always look up waiting for a lightning bolt to hit me because I'm thinking for myself. Nope. No need to do that any longer. The truth of existence, right, shows what God is doing and what we can do to align with that. Christ talks about that in Letter 1, if Christ returns, reveal startling truth. Hey, if this is what divine consciousness is doing, helping you grow, nurturing and nourishing you, healing you, protecting you, fulfilling your needs, providing work and survival and rhythm, and all within the spiritual law and order system, including the law of cause and effect, don't you think you might want to align with those energies as compared to, if God's doing that, I'm going to go in a different direction. Okay? That's like disobeying gravity. But gravity doesn't mind if I disobey it. It doesn't mind if I obey it. Gravity is just being gravity. If I jump off the top roof of the roof of a building, gravity is not going, I'm going to punish this guy. Not happening. But there will be consequences. Cause and effect. Oh. God doesn't punish. Oh, that guy jumped off the building and God punished him. No, that's not actually true. Law of cause and effect. Human bodies jumping off the top floor of the building, falling some stories, are going to hit the ground hard. We can learn how to cause positive effects, but it takes practice. The law of cause and effect, just like trial and error, is like, I'm trying to cause, whoops, I didn't like that effect. Trying to cause, oh, I didn't like that effect. Trying to cause, ooh, I like that effect. We practice that for baseball and basketball and sports and writing and dancing and walking and standing and running and a million other things. It's like, oh. I practice causing it. I notice the effect. I adjust my cause. There you have it. That's a differentiator between the 97% and the 3%. I cause an effect, notice what it is, and then I adjust my cause. And I learn from that experience. That's the differentiator. Oh, that's cool. That's cool. So we can learn to cause positive effects. Yeah, yeah. And the way to do it is not, I'll do it perfectly the first time or I'll quit. No. It takes practice. Our needs are being fulfilled. I think if we buy this, our needs are being fulfilled easily sometimes and with difficulty other times, depending on how resistant, how unaware, how pig-headed we can be. I don't know why we pick on the pigs for that, but we do. A person like a dog on a bone, pig-headed. That's an interesting animal there, a dog-headed pig, pig-headed dog. I don't know. But if we recognize that our needs are being fulfilled, we like, I guess I don't have to be as anxious and fearful. I don't have to stay in the 97%. I can move over. And instead of being 97.3, maybe it's a 95.5, or maybe 90.10, and maybe 80.20. We can do this. The choice is ours. The choice is ours. If we turn around and go, the reason I'm in the 97% or the reason I'm in the 3% is essentially the same thing, is because of thoughts, feelings, words, and actions. It's my consciousness. It's my mindset. It's my attitude. You know, oh, yeah, that's right. All of this, I could probably have summed this up, you know, in one sentence, be a short talk. That the difference between the 97% and the 3% are the mindsets, the attitudes, the consciousness, the clarity of will, and the clarity of purpose. Will and purpose. What do you want? Why do you want it? And how much horsepower are you devoted to that particular thing? If we think we're like as powerful as a little teeny lawnmower or even less, then we better not take you on too many challenges. If we're going to climb a high hill, we're going to need some more horsepower than that. Those five items, there's nothing preventing a person in the 97% group from elevating himself or herself to the 3% group, other than those five things. Mindsets, attitudes, consciousness, clarity of will, and clarity of purpose. Those five things are completely within the control of 100% of us. So why don't I work on my consciousness, cleanse my consciousness? Why don't I become aware of my mindset, my attitudes? Why don't I clarify what my will is in this particular activity and my purpose? In a case like that, we would be in the higher level percentage. Better it should be reversed. 97% of people are extremely effective, and 3% of the people, due to physical limitations or brain injury, are not able to cause desirable effects. But the 97% can. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveal Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our help, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you're perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, We are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.